Hey, welcome to the Tater Report. It's CIUT 89.5 FM, and today we're going to be talking to Glenn Ford of BlackAgendaReport.com about this widespread activity, demonstrations in the streets in the United States. There have been demonstrations here under the slogan Black Lives Matter. So we want to talk to Glenn about what's unfolding there and get an analysis from him. And at 5:30 today, we'll be talking to David Jacobs, a Toronto lawyer who has practiced at international law. We're going to be talking about the recent decision, the big one, of the judges at the International Criminal Court in The Hague who have dismissed the case against Uhuru Kenyatta. That's a very, very important development. There's we have statements from the defense in that matter, as well as from Uhuru Kenyatta himself, and we'll be talking about that at 5:30. I think we are joined now by Mr. Glenn Ford. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I'm right here. How you doing?
Very well, and we're really glad to be talking to you because America seems to be trembling. There's some kind of something's going on, and Mr. Dillon doesn't understand, does he? I mean, something is afoot here. Let's start with this. We've had three really shocking cases of unarmed black Americans being killed, followed at least in two instances by the so-called justice system with grand juries who cleared the officers who did the killing. That's been followed by these demonstrations, which are, and I want to ask you about that. I mean, why people are reacting as they are, and what is it you think that they, what they're calling for, what you think they should call for?
Well, what's shocking, it's shocking to the folks in power, is not these incidents. It's not the impunity with which police behave on the streets of black America. That's an everyday occurrence. And it's not the failure to indict these police when they commit homicide in plain view and in front of cameras. That's par for the course in the United States. It's the reaction that is different and that is making the people in power tremble. That sensation that you're feeling.
Yeah, and it's certainly, by the way, you would be interested. Toronto had a big demonstration in front of the U.S. consulate led by African Canadians who took up the slogan Black Lives Matter.
This has had the effect of re-energizing the remnants of the Occupy Wall Street movement of a couple of years ago. So we have a lot of non-black participation here. The same forces that were in motion a couple of years ago around Occupy. It's not just catching on in Canada, it's catching on in demographic precincts here in the United States that are newly active.
Yeah, we have that phenomenon. We all remember that, or should, that Martin Luther King said the world is watching. Judging by reports I've seen from around the world, that is definitely the case. You know, I'm reminded he wrote a book, which I don't see people quoted often enough, the lovely title, a lovely, smart title. He said, Why We Can't Wait.
And that was about the Birmingham experience in '63.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, there was a meeting with the President of the United States, which it was reported at BlackAgendaReport.com. I really urge everybody to please go to that site, read, and fill in the details of this. But the President and the Attorney General took a kind of preemptive action. Could you tell us about that meeting? You featured it at Black Agenda Report. What was going on there?
Well, they're trying to shore up the forces of accommodation in the black community and bring in some of those new forces that they hope they can co-opt and convert. That's what last Monday's meeting was about. Of course, the Rasputin running around in the back rooms there is Reverend Al Sharpton. Reverend Al Sharpton is President Obama's pit bull when it comes to black affairs. He poses as an activist, leaning on his past activities, and then goes right back to the White House to give advice to the people in power in terms of strategy to head off this growing movement in the making.
Mm-hmm.
What they do in practical effect is talk about what can the administration propose, what kind of concessions, if that's the right word, mm-hmm. Can it make to this movement that might slow it down. So it's more of a collaboration than a negotiation. Sharpton will say, well, go with the body cameras after already having been told by Eric Holder that they're willing to concede on body cameras and offers of long-term investigations into various cities and police departments that would just stretch out the power, stretch out the clock.
Yeah. Let me ask you about that point. I think everyone, you know, in a way, history is kind of putting potholes in front of them as they think they're going down a highway. They said on one, you know, in apropos of Ferguson, oh, yes, we need a body camera. At that point, they had a body lying in a street. And there were, boy, were there was no shortage of cameras. And it sort of immediately caused a stumble on the part of those who said, oh, a body camera would solve the problem. You know, it seems to be inviting almost a kind of voyeurism. Let's all watch these horrible deaths.
Well, understand that this is a country in which lynchings were big social events, in which thousands of white folks would come, bring their children, bring picnic lunches, to watch the spectacle of a dangling black body, shoot it full of holes, then burn it, then cut off pieces as souvenirs, then take pictures to mass produce as postcards and send to all your friends. So this was a great kind of Roman circus that was held with regularity in the South and not so far deep in the South in the United States. During my father's lifetime, so we should not be surprised when we see bodies like that of Michael Brown being left in the middle of the street in broad daylight. We know what that's meant, the effect that it's meant to invoke.
But in terms of this has to be the great issue for those who are providing leadership to a movement which has a high degree of spontaneity, communities that are just fed up, deciding which things to focus on. I was wondering, I would get your thoughts about, I read that Ferguson, for example, has something like 25 police officers, 22 of them are white. Why can't that be changed to, you know, now? Why can't there be, how do you end up with an apartheid police force in a black community?
Well, Ferguson is one of those quickly changing communities, which used to be a white flight suburb when whites were leaving St. Louis in the 50s and 60s and early 70s, and St. Louis was becoming a majority black city. That's where the white folks went, to places like Ferguson. And even in the year 2000, Ferguson still had a slight white majority. So this is a new population in terms of black folks, many of them the product of push-out by gentrification. And it's a white population that had already run away from blacks in a previous generation. And so we see the black population being so new, it's almost transient, and transients don't vote. And so you have a 53, I think, member police force with only three blacks on it. The problem here, however, is we shouldn't be focusing on the racial composition of the Ferguson police force as the problem. Mm-hmm. And the young people who are organizing in Ferguson are not. Getting more black police on that force is not one of the top demands of the most active young elements in Ferguson and St. Louis. Remember, Ferguson is like an extension of St. Louis. St. Mm-hmm. Louis has had a black mayor. St. Louis has had a black police chief. In fact, its former black police chief is now working for the governor as head of public safety and in charge of the state police in Missouri. And yet black folks get shot down like dogs every day mm-hmm. on the streets of St. Louis. So the young folks of greater St. Louis know that getting more black cops is not solving mm-hmm. The problem. It's the police and their relationship to the community.
Yeah, and the
it's
policy.
The community's powerlessness that is the problem, and mm-hmm. not just how many dark policemen there are.
Well, I'm glad you spoke to that. The other matter that is that this sort of form of taxation of black people by serving warrants on people. And I think you have 2,400 people, and you have 2,500 warrants issued.
It is absolutely amazing, and it's shocking.
What a way to raise money off the poor.
And I thought I was unshockable. Here's the fact. In Ferguson, which is two-thirds black, and that means there's about 20,000 black folks there, the average black household in Ferguson has three warrants per household. Three warrants per household, almost all of them for traffic. Now, understand what that means. That means that in Ferguson, a policeman could walk down the street and put his hands on just about any person, young or mature, and the odds are that that person would have an outstanding warrant on them. Imagine the kind of impunity that that officer feels that he has, that anybody he touches is outside of the law because there's a warrant on them. And statistically, it would be a good bet that anybody he reaches out and touches would be fair game in that kind of regard.
And this leads directly into the issue, which has been identified, and you refer to it in your article, the imprisoning, the new Jim Crow policy on blacks in prisons and being almost every, as you just described, being people who their rights have been taken away because they've been incriminated. Their label has been put on them.
This is all an outgrowth of the imposition of the mass black incarceration regime. And the wonderment is not that it's happening now in 2014. It is why we have not had this kind of nationwide movement much sooner. We've had this mass black incarceration regime for two generations now. It began definitively in the late 60s with the establishment of the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration. That was part of a bill, an omnibus crime bill signed into law by President Johnson, the great liberal, the great mm-hmm. friend of black and poor people, in 1968. And the LEAA began the process of the militarization of the police. It was the vehicle through which millions upon millions of dollars were transferred from the federal coffers to local and state police departments. It transformed policing in America. And one of its first outgrowths was the creation of SWAT teams. They began in California, and the first use of the first SWAT team was against the Black Panther Party's headquarters in Los Angeles in 1969. SWAT was conceived as a counterinsurgency, that means counter-black insurgency mechanism. And today we have 80,000 SWAT raids every year. 80,000 every year, starting from that one raid on the Black Panther Party headquarters in 1969. That was its genesis, but the character of it is the same. It is counterinsurgency. It is preemptive. It is why black folks are treated as potential enemy combatants and then become enemy combatants, and everything flows from that, and that has been in place for 45 damn years. Mm-hmm. So this is not something sudden. If anything, it is something that is pent up. I also want to point out something else historically. Every black rebellion in the United States since 1935, with the first black urban rebellion in Harlem in that year, has been sparked by police abuse of the black community. And we can even include the nationwide rebellions in 1968 after the assassination of Martin Luther King in that category, since universally black folks assumed that he was killed by the state. So mm-hmm. that's also part of the state murdering black people. So mm-hmm. so this is part of the historical black pattern with black folks. And again, it's a wonderment that we have seen this spasm, which we hope is a movement, mm-hmm. so late in the game.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly it's unprecedented in recent years, this kind of reaction. I don't know exactly what is happening in Berkeley, Oakland, but there have been shocking pictures from there where apparently the police decided that they were going to just not let people use the streets. That's the impression I get.
The police see this as what it is. I think the police are quite clear, and the organizers are becoming more clear. You know, this movement does not have a name because the people directly involved are not quite clear about where they're going, although the logic is inexorable. And the police see this as a challenge to their legitimacy. It actually is a challenge to the legitimacy of state power, because the police are the mm-hmm. organs of coercion of the state. They're the ones who have the monopoly on the use of force. And the police see this movement as challenging that. That's what it is. We'll find words to make a slogan, or they will find words, the young folks who are most active in it, in due time.
Mm-hmm. Well, Black Lives Matter is pretty good. By the way, you must be impressed at the courage of black athletes like Reggie Bush and the players for the St. Louis Rams. That's been a surprising development.
Oh, it sounds again. The analogy is not to the civil rights movement, not to Birmingham. It's to 1968 and the image out of Mexico City. That's what it's more like. It's more like the Black Power era than the Civil Rights era.
Yeah, I think it was John Carlos, so the his partner that has already issued a statement saying, "I knew this was going to happen." He said, "When I did that in '68, I knew there would be another generation, and now it's happening."
Yes, and he was right, and I'm glad he didn't hold his breath, but it's here, and I'm sure he's. It's wonderful for him to see it.
Yeah. Now, you have been one of those who pointed out that you've had a problem. People said, "Oh, well, we've elected the president who preaches hope, and he is a black American, and we had to go through this period of everybody saying, well, then the racial issue is behind us. Now we have this meeting in the White House." I was struck, but they reported that his words were, "You have to go slow, and you have to be minimal." Minimal. Amazing, isn't it?
Well, yeah, no, but this is the same guy who, in 2007, when he was first began his campaign, and he decided to say these words in Selma at a meeting memorializing that previous movement. This is the guy who said that blacks had already come 90% of the way to equality. And, of course, his inference 90%. Was that if he got elected to be president, well, that's the last 10%, and we will have arrived.
that's a cherry on the top. That would be the...
yeah.
You know, by the way, I mean, another helpful comment, you must have been impressed too with this. Chris Rock said, "They tell us we've made progress." He says, we're not making progress. White people are less crazy. to the extent, if you say that there's been advancement, there's just less craziness. And he said, we were ready to be president, obviously, from the beginning. A rather helpful dialectical way of looking at it.
Well, you know, ever since I was a little boy, so I'm sure it predates me, one of the little games, universal skits in black communities, usually over a couple of pints, was the game of populating the administration with black people. So whoever the top black folks were in various different fields, we'd all have fun appointing them Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense or War and mm-hmm. Secretary of Education. It was always a really funny skit, and everybody did it. So black folks were always projecting ourselves as filling these offices, mm-hmm. never expecting that it would become true. Well, when it did become true, when the real golden ring, not the brass ring, went to Barack Obama, this created or made acute the most serious black political crisis since the turn of the 20th century, when mm-hmm. there was the great clash between Booker T. Washington's accommodationism and forces around what would become the Niagara Movement, and then the NAACP, who were demanding total social equality for blacks. And Booker T. Was talking about minimalism, mm-hmm. incrementalism, mm-hmm. and the doctrine that went down as accommodationism. And that created a huge crisis in black America. W.E.B. Du Bois was the great adversary of Booker mm-hmm. T. And with the rise of Obama, a similar crisis mm-hmm. occurred. And it neutralized for a time black America as a transformational force. Mm-hmm. Because masses of black folks, not just the black misleadership class, but masses of folks, the same folks who, like me, played that skit game of populating an administration with all of our leaders yeah. in various cabinet positions, yeah. All of a sudden there it was, and people were identifying with power and felt that they had to be protective of power, more protective of Obama than Obama was protective of black people. Mm-hmm. And so we saw this age of Obama marked by a great quietude in black America, in which half of the Congressional Black Caucus in 2011 voted to continue the unprecedented air war against an African country, against Libya. And I mm-hmm. know you and people close to you have done such mm-hmm. Great work on that issue. And then in June of this year, and I suppose the caucus thought it was voting in the dark, but 80% of the Congressional Black Caucus voted to continue the Pentagon's transfers of weapons and other military gear to local police departments and state police. 80%, four out of five of them. In other words, they were financing the cops who put on their militaristic Fallujah-like display in Ferguson. Mm-hmm. You see, we had come that far. So this movement breaks out, I guess they always do, it breaks out just in time to reverse that anomaly in black history, to bring us back to where we have historically always been as the most anti-militarist, the most progressive ethnic group in the United States, the folks who take the lead in pushing for social transformation. Finally, we're back where mm-hmm. in our usual place.
Hallelujah, I would say. Yeah. Now, this is, of course, Glenn Ford, last question, and I really appreciate all the time you're giving us. Since this is identifying the issue of lynching/legal lynching, Which, of course, the old lynching in Jim Crow era, that's what that was. Sheriffs stood around while those crowds lynched people or took them out of jails. This happens to be almost a daily phenomenon in America. So if that's going to be the issue, we're probably in for a stormy period, aren't we?
Yeah, it's going to be a stormy period. Now, the activists are not trying to create conditions for violence. They're quite disciplined. Mm-hmm. But violence is inevitable in this kind of confrontation.
It's certainly up to the police departments of how they're going to treat unarmed blacks who are simply going about their business.
Violence is inevitable because the police will make it so. Yes. As we were discussing earlier, they see this correctly as a challenge to their legitimacy. They're not going to stand for it. And what we used to call the brothers and sisters on the block, mm-hmm. I'm talking about the unorganized elements, are not going to stand for being physically abused, and they're going to want payback. So there's going to be violence. And the danger, therefore, the immediate danger, is allowing these accommodationist Negroes, the Sharptons et al., to drive a wedge within the community between the so-called violent folk who will be unnamed and faceless and the responsible people who they will characterize as being themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And we already see this. We saw Sharpton very early on remarking every chance he got about the dangers of those knuckleheads who might destroy the movement by committing violence.
Mm-hmm.
This is where the political discipline comes in.
Yeah.
Among the organizers to not allow that wedge to be driven.
Yeah, and your target here is police racial violence, and it's got to come to an end. It's a vast movement, and
you can't have an anti-police movement and conduct yourself consistently with respect towards the police. How is that possible?
I think you pose exactly right. Glenn Ford, blackagendareport.com, and we're really glad to be talking to you.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity.
Okay.
And for the work that you do, Matt.
Thank you. Bye-bye. It's Glenn Ford, blackagendareport.com. Terrific site. It's very well written. And by the way, what I like, Glenn in particular, delivers his he writes editorials, but then he reads them. And so you just go to the site, you can click and listen to about four and a half minute editorial message. It's excellent. This is the Taylor Report. It's CIUT 89.5 FM. There's a song by Hughie Leadbelly about Washington, D.C., so we'll play a bit of that.